Welcome to the Cosmic Eye Show, where we explore spiritual ideas and books that help you live a better life. Hosted by spiritual teacher and author of If You Can Worry, You Can Meditate, Jason Napolitano.
All right, hello. Welcome to the Cosmic Eye Show. I'm your host, Jason Napolitano, and on the phone with me, it is my pleasure to welcome Chris Sheridan live from LA. I'm here in Vegas. How you doing, Chris?
I'm doing great, Jason. Great to be here again.
I love this show, and I look forward to our talk today. Thanks again for showing up. I am the author of If You Can Worry, You Can Meditate, and you can find that on Amazon. Chris is the author of The Spirit in the Sky, also on Amazon, or his website, chrissheridan.com, or you can check out my website, cosmiceye.org. All right, we got that out of the way. Today we are talking about the life and writings of Thoth Hermes Trismegistus, the thrice greatest Hermes. This is out of Mammy Hall's Secret Teachings, but we'll also be drawing from some other stuff as well. It's going to be a neat show. So let's just jump right into it. So the big question here that a lot of people have to begin with is who is Hermes? Who is Hermes Trismegistus? Who is Thoth? So let's talk a little bit about that, Chris.
Okay.
How do you just start, actually? You start in and tell me some of the ideas that pop into your head, who this particular person / mythological figure. Because it does seem to be, there does seem to be some debate as to whether he was an actual person or if he's a conglomeration of different teachers or some sort of a mythological or god-type figure. So can you get into a little of that for us?
Okay, well, this... First of all, his moniker, this thrice greatest, this Trismegistus, is in, I guess, a trinitary form of Hermes, Thoth, from the Egyptian, and then Mercury, the messenger of the gods. That is, that thrice greatest does relate to those three, I guess, cultural origins. You know, the Egyptians, you have, and the Greeks with the different... origins of that, and whether or not Hermes was an actual person, I would imagine there's, like Lao Tzu, there's even some debate whether Lao Tzu, the author of the great Tao, the Tao Te Ching, may or may not have been a person. The same debate rages with Shakespeare, whether it was Marlowe and Bacon and some other people, and they all kind of got together as a writing group. But either way, Hermes seems to be the Western version that to this day, and we even say, hermetically sealed, and that relates to Hermes. But in essence, it's a bringer of knowledge, a mediator between universal mind, the God wisdom, and the earth plane with the human beings. Mm-hmm. That role is significant in so many cultures. This seems to be one of the archetypal ones, though, the one that really goes back and maybe is a connecting point with a lot of other traditions since.
That's a great point. Another understanding of that thrice greatest is that he was considered the greatest of philosophers, the greatest of priests, and the greatest of kings. So in addition to his three main images of Thoth, Hermes and Mercury, that's another understanding as well, the symbolic understanding of that thrice greatest as well. Interesting thing, he is actually considered to be connected to the Greek messenger god Hermes, although it's kind of tangential, but he does figure into that as well. But he's definitely, as you said, a communicator between the higher and the lower, between man and between the divine mind or the gods. And I think that's an important attribution. They also say that he revealed to mankind medicine, chemistry, law, art, astrology, music, rhetoric, magic, philosophy, geography, mathematics, geometry, anatomy, and oratory. So those are some pretty heavy things that he brought to us. So for that reason, we can see why the ancients revered him so much, in that, He was bringing them the wisdom that helped them to shape their worlds, essentially. So I find that quite interesting. Most of what we know about Hermes comes from some fragments. There is not a complete set of works, because the early Christians burned the Library of Alexandria, apparently. We don't really know that for a fact, but the Library of Alexandria was burned, and many of these writings were lost. And, you know, some of the ancients believe that he wrote as many as, what was it, 20 or 30,000 different things. So obviously this is a pseudonym then at that point for some type of a wise figure. 36,000, Manetho said, and Iamblichus said that he wrote almost 20,000 books. So, you know, if that was a single person, that would be extremely, you know, difficult for them to pull that off, obviously. So it was probably a pseudonym that many people were using. The most important records or works that we still have is the Corpus Hermeticum, which was originally translated by Marsilio Ficino into Latin in Italy during the Renaissance, and that was funded by the Medicis, actually. So much of what we have actually comes down to us through the Renaissance. And so these Hermetic ideas were solidified, I mean, in their sort of more modern forms, certainly during that time. So let's talk about a little bit of a few of the groups that draw their wisdom from these original Hermetic teachings, this Corpus Hermeticum, of which mainly they're pulling from the Divine Pimander or Poimander, depending on how you want to pronounce it, and the emerald. They use the Emerald Tablet a lot, which we're not going to talk about, and then a writing, the more modern Hermeticists or Hermetists use this writing called the Kabbalion, which came out, I think, what was it, 1910 or something?
Yeah, early 1900s.
Yeah, and it was based on these Hermetic teachings.
The seven Hermetic principles.
The seven Hermetic principles, exactly. So let's talk a little bit about some of these groups, though, that were influenced. I mean, there's such a wide range of different groups that draw from this. Let's say here, too, we talked about this a little bit earlier, that the idea of one of the main ideas of the followers of this, of Hermes Trismegistus or Thoth, because they became linked together. Thoth, of course, is the ibis-headed god of Egypt, who was the recorder of your deeds during your weighing of the soul in the underworld. And so he's a messenger, he's a divine messenger. And so they became linked together in Egypt under the Ptolemies, when the Greeks controlled Egypt. That's when a lot of these things became fused together. And the Egyptian and Greek mythologies and worldviews are very, they work together well. So it wasn't a great stretch to mold those two things together. So anyway, out of this, one of the main ideas of these early Hermeticists was the idea that there was an original religion that was given to man by God, and that this sort of golden thread or golden chain or archetypal religious base for all of these religions is contained in all of the religions of today in lesser and greater amounts. So that's something that was picked up by the 19th and 20th century magicians and hermeticists, theosophists, and some of these different new Rosicrucian groups, certainly by the Freemasons, later by Thelema, Crowley's work group that he founded, his religion that he founded, and so on. Hermetic Order of the Golden Dawn, Hermetic Brotherhood of Light. These are some of these groups that came as a result of these Hermetic ideas. But going back, you know, let's talk a little bit about alchemy, about some of these original ideas that came through. Gnosticism came up at the same time as some of these Hermetic ideas, so you see a lot of spillover. That being said, much of what we read today in the Secret Teachings deals with a lot of that. And so I would highly recommend reading this chapter in the Secret Teachings, The Life and Writings of Thoth Hermes Trismegistus. So anyway, let's get back to that, some of these groups. So how did you understand that some of these different groups, these early groups, when I say like the alchemists, early astrology, some of the ideas of astrotheology and stuff, how do we see those filter down into some of those ideas, some of these Hermetic ideas? Can you tell me a little bit about that you understood?
Well, just going back to that, there is, I guess, inroads that show this as being a source or built on several sources from which these others borrowed. There was so much borrowing, in the Near East and, certainly around that time, a couple thousand years ago, through trade routes and just such a rich intermingling of cultures, it's mm-hmm. not surprising that, some imagery, some mythology, some spiritual principles would be shared by several cultures, especially if, and this is, what we're getting at here, that they do relate to some underlying universal
truth. Exactly. Yeah, good
and
point.
That being the case, then it almost doesn't matter who or what, comes out of that or emanates from that, as long as it retains a little bit of that source. When we see the flowering of the different traditions and cultural practices,
sure.
Since they share a common ancestry, so to speak.
Yeah, that's great.
It's, I think it's because they share that common source, that may be more of where the transference of this information instead of, not quite as much from one to the other once they were fully formed. I think they were formed from, they were maybe cut from the same cloth.
That's a great way to put it. Yeah. And I think that's what's interesting too about how, the early Gnostic Christians were in this school of thought. And that really is one of the, later on, one of the issues that the more Orthodox members of the church began to attack them, destroy their materials, excommunicate them, kill them in many cases, and so on, and drive those streams of early Christian thought that were kind of opposed to some of these more Orthodox ideas of Christianity, the doctrines, the dogmas, and so on. They drove those ideas underground. And I think that's where you see later on, they pop their heads back up in the Rosicrucian movements and in the Renaissance and in humanism and the reflowering of the sort of pagan traditions and the interest in magic and astrology and so on. So these ideas, those golden chain ideas, those universal religious ideas really were kept alive by these different groups in different ways. And I find
ironically,
that fascinating.
By keeping it secret.
By keeping it secret, exactly. And speaking of that, this is one thing I found fascinating. We talked about this a little bit earlier. Manly Hall talks about it, and he says this on page 96 of the Reader's Edition of Secret Teachings. The volumes which escaped the fire, which we talked about in the Alexandrian library burned, the volumes which escaped the fire were buried in the desert, and their location is now known to only a few initiates of the secret schools. Now, he wrote this probably sometime in 1925, 26. This book wasn't published until 1928. And then in 1947, 48, the Nag Hammadi find in Egypt was discovered. And Hermetic fragments of books were actually found among other writings, biblical and Gnostic. And that's an interesting thing. So almost, 20-something years later, my math is horrible. Here these fragments are actually found, and Manly Hall is speaking of some hidden buried volumes which escaped the fire. And essentially that wisdom that was found at Nag Hammadi is, you know, what became the Gnostic Gospels and so forth. And some of the these
Gospel
different, the Gospel of Thomas was found, and some of these, I think Gospel of Philip and Mary and some of these important Gnostic Gospels were also found, but so were fragments of some of these Hermetic texts. And so it's interesting that he's almost pointing to maybe there's another cache of these somewhere in Egypt where all of the documents exist, or where all 42, Clement, one of the early church fathers, talks about how there were 42 books that he knew of that the Hermeticists spoke of. So it's interesting. Maybe they'll find another cache of these books at some point, and that would be an amazing find. But the point is that this wisdom tradition is still alive today. It's still, it's more alive than ever in some ways in the new age world. Many people are interested in alchemy, in astrology, and different forms of magic and theurgy, the pagan traditions, the mythology, and so on that have been popularized again. So these things actually are flowering like they haven't in hundreds and hundreds of years, because the church was so dominant with its single point of view for so long. So it's interesting. That's a bit of a tangent, but I wanted to bring that up. I found that really, really, really cool. So maybe there is out there.
Remains to be discovered.
It does remain to be discovered.
Rediscovered.
And there's another thing too that I found really interesting. He goes on after that and then talks about this is more symbolic, I think, and more sort of mythological. But he talks about the Book of Thoth and its possible connection to the tarot. So this is a secret book, essentially. Nothing's ever been found of this book, but people have hinted at it and spoke about it, that this secret book was the way to really sort of a God consciousness, guide to sort of finding this consciousness of immortality, where you'd be able to sort of rise to the level and sort of speak with the gods or, the divine mind and so on. And then it was a sort of a key to immortality, in essence, that you would find eternal life if you understood this Book of Thoth. And then there's some connections to the tarot. It's some of those symbolic representations in the tarot are supposedly, possibly go back to this ancient Book of Thoth. I mean, Crowley certainly thought so. He wrote a book called the Book of Thoth, and his most famous deck is based on this idea. So some kind of fascinating connections there, whether or not
even
it's historical.
Even something modern like The Secret and this Law of Attraction.
Yeah.
Which is drawn more from the Emerald Tablets, which really deserves its own episode. And I certainly
we'll get to that.
As above, so below, like attracts like and whatnot.
Yeah, exactly. I definitely like to do that. And I think our listeners would really dig a show like that. And it'd be nice to do an episode on the Divine Perimeter as well.
The Kabbalion. That's getting republished now. It's really gaining a lot of popularity. But this particular chapter really tends to focus on what's known as the vision of Hermes. That is how, and this is Hermes in his human earth form that received a divine revelation from this luminous dragon flying.
Oh, I hear that. I hear the dog.
And in that, yes, actually, the facing image, the beautiful color plates and the secret teachings, the facing one for this chapter is one of Hermes. And in one hand, he has the Emerald Tablet. And in another hand, he's holding up the caduceus that we easily recognize from any doctor's office.
The medical.
Medical
symbol. Yeah.
And he's stepping on this dragon, this typhon. It looks like half between a dragon and a alligator or something, and
a dragon, an alligator, and a hog. I think that's his mix.
That's a terrible combination. But he's stepping on it, and it's like the stuff of the earth that we can get so consumed by that draws us in. We're part of it because
it drags us down, though. That's the portion that drags us down.
It needs to be conquered. So he's stepping on top of this thing. But also, yes, there is a dog image. And, I always thought that was interesting. But in reading the caption, it's talking about the symbol being of wisdom, because dogs are pretty smart.
Sure.
And loyalty.
Loyalty.
So a dog being loyal to a human master, relating to kind of the loyalty and dependence that we might feel towards the divine presence.
That's a great point. In Jungian dream interpretation, a dog is often, I mean, of course, it's going to come down to an individual's own interpretations, but an archetypal idea for a dog in a dream is one's positive instinctual nature.
Like Toto. Toto was always
The Wizard Toto, of Oz. Exactly.
It seemed like it did the wrong thing. The humans really got upset whenever Toto did something, but each time
he did. But it always had a point.
It was always to move the story and the humans to where they needed to go.
Yep.
Relying on instinct. Yes.
Exactly. Great point. So great point there. Yeah. That vision section really, really does need to be read. It's such a cool thing because Manly Hall is such a beautiful writer. And what he does is he takes some of those fragments, and essentially the divine Pimander is written in sort of a dialogue form, not sort of, it is a dialogue form. So he takes that and he takes these different fragments that he has access to, and he writes this in a narrative that's easier to read, that actually is really beautifully written and very symbolic and quite deep. And it's interesting because there's that portion of it that you'll read if you check out the book, but there's the portion, and we talked about this a little bit in a couple of podcasts ago when you spoke about astrotheology. Which one was that in? By the way, when did you speak of that? That was in
was it the meditation disciplines?
No,
you did a two.
No, it was there. Like two episodes ago. We were talking about astrotheology. Anyway, I'll take a look and.
Well, it's worth repeating because it comes up.
It
a
is.
Lot.
I'll look it up and I'll put it in the Great. Comments. So if the listener wants to reference that, check the comments section, the description section of the podcast, and I'll put it in there. At any rate, he talks about how when you're sort of ascending after the body, after you're dropping off the body after death, first of all, it's an involution or an evolutionary process. The involution is when we come down into the body and we come through these seven spheres. The evolution is when we die either physically or we die sort of to the physical nature of ourselves, and we rise up through these seven spheres. And of course, one is reminded of the seven chakras. And then the release or the mukti from this plane of existence. So that would be sort of a death while still in the body, or a death of the body, and then us ascending spiritually. But that reminded me of that astrotheology that you talked about. Can you kind of recap that really, really quickly? How that occurs through the planets and what's kind of dropping off as you go? Do you remember that portion?
Sure. Well, it approaches what's called the hard problem in science, and that is, how does mind interact with matter, or spirit with body? And from an astrotheological point of view, the spirit has to come through the seven rings of the orbits of the Ptolemaic system of Earth being in the center, of course.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
So through Saturn, Jupiter, Mars, the Sun, Venus, Mercury, the Moon. To get to this plane. So in each one is adding a layer of attribution that spirit would not have. But in earthly life, we either need or we need to have to be able to transcend. And then at death, it's a reverse order. So in this context, he's talking about the reverse order. So to return after, the lower nature has been conquered, and then you return back to the spiritual source from which it came, that the body, that it's separation, the body returns to the earth, earthy, mm-hmm. and the elements and all the things that compose the carbon and everything that compose the body stays on the earth. But our essence, our soul, our spirit, goes back up through these orbits of the planets, the first nearest one being the moon.
Mm-hmm.
Because the moon changes in phase, increases and diminishes, and that's something we need on Earth. Mercury, the next one, all the machinations of deceit and craftiness, he says. Venus, lusts and passions. These are kind of the negative.
These are dropping away. These are dropping away from the soul as you're ascending.
And these that had been put on, think of it as like a coat of seven layers or something.
Yeah, exactly.
And so then at release, these get released, Mars, the sun.
Venus, then the sun,
Then the fourth one is the sun, So ambitions and Mars, boldness and warlikeness, mm-hmm, rashness.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Jupiter, the next one, largeness, accumulation of riches. And then Saturn, which is the gate of chaos that, you know, falsehood and evil plotting. It's unfortunate that we have to put on all these attributes to live on the earth plane. And I guess it's fortunate that we have to, or that we can anyway, we release them,
yeah,
as we move off. But symbolically, the symbolic death that we face while the body is still alive and we're still integrated, is that we do shed these things even while we're still here.
Yeah, exactly. And that's what I was talking about, like being in the body and ascending sort of spiritually, or, you know, leaving the body and ascending, the body itself, leaving the body, you know, one is the sort of symbolic death or the philosophic death. And one is, yes, like the actual death, which we've talked about many times.
Metaphor is the same.
Yeah, exactly.
You know,
exactly.
And so this is the lesson, the allegory, is that we have to shed ourselves of those attachments to those things. It's very, very Buddhist in that sense.
Absolutely. And it's interesting, you should say Buddhist, by the way, because I do think a lot of these teachings do seem to have ancient Indian or Indic traditions mixed into them. And Buddhism, of course, coming out of India before it became popular in China and so on, when it moved out into Asia and Southeast Asia, it was obviously its original home was India. I don't want to jump to something, but that reminded me of something we talked about earlier, is that there's a really interesting section of this that that kind of gets into mind, where he's talking about mind. And you know, one of the modern sort of exponents of these ideas in a different way, in a more Indian Vedic tradition, the Vedanta tradition from the Upanishads and Bhagavad Gita, is the Vedanta tradition. There's a modern sort of version of the Vedanta. It's called the Vedanta Temple, and it's in the United States and all over the U.S. And it was originated by Vivekananda here in the United States. At least one branch of it was. But one of the teachers back in India is called Sri Ramana Maharishi, and I've been reading his work lately. Anyway, I'm just going to say this real quickly. There's a section in here. It's on page 102, and it's pointed out that in the section, the vision of the Divine Pimander, he's saying, Hermes next inquired about the road by which the wise attain to life eternal. And Pimander continued, "Let the man endued with a mind mark, consider, and learn of himself, and with the power of his mind divide himself from his not self and become a servant of reality." Become a servant of reality. So essentially, you're freeing yourself from the idea that you are not the absolute, you are not this divine mind that he calls the not self, and then you, by doing so, you become self-realized. You see the reality or the absolute. And then I found this section from Ramana Maharishi, and he's a early 20th century, mid 20th century philosopher of Vedanta. And he says, "There is no moment when the self is not. So long as there is doubt or the feeling of non-realization, the attempt should be made to rid oneself of these thoughts. When the not self disappears, the self alone remains." The self alone remains. So these ideas, this idea of this perennial philosophy or this golden chain, is still alive today in many, many, many religious ideas. And you can see it right there. That's a modern saying of an ancient Vedic or ancient Indian truth there. So quite interesting.
Well, it underscores the idea that what we truly are, our true divine nature, our immortal infinite self, is already there. It doesn't need to be cultivated.
It's already there.
Or yeah. It's either asleep in matter because we're so involved in the world and earthly things, or it's covered up. But it's not there. It's you know, so it's either, you know, just lost in the shuffle with daily life, or we become so enamored and so attached by things of the world that, and this notion of being asleep, Buddha was asked, you know, are you enlightened? And he goes, no, I'm awake.
Yeah. And there's actually, there's in this Hermetic work, there's a point where he speaks about that. Remember we were talking about that, where Hermes is besought to teach the way of life. And so he's not, it is a sort of, he's trying to teach people how to wake up in essence. Oh, here it is. I just found it. 104 on page 104. He said, "Oh, people of earth, men born and made of the elements, but with the spirit of the divine mind within you, rise from your sleep of ignorance. Mm-hmm. Be sober and thoughtful. Realize that your home is not the earth, but in the light." I mean, that's the stuff. That's Jesus. The kingdom of heaven is within. I and the Father are one. I mean, that's...
Oh, it very much is. In fact, you could see the Christian story, the Jesus as being a intermediary between God and maybe being a teacher. And even some of the direct principles very much relate, very analogous to the Hermetic tradition.
Well, it's interesting because the early Hermetic followers accused the Christians of stealing their ideas and trying to shut them out, essentially saying, well, no, these are universal ideas. Christianity is not the only one who has these ideas. So you can't tell us that, you know, your way is the only way, because we had these contemporary with you or even before. And I think that's one of the interesting things that's a challenge for Orthodox Christianity in some ways, especially in today's multi-religious, multicultural, multi-pluralistic and so on world, is that Christianity does have all of these elements of this universal truth in it. One of the challenges, though, is that it often will say, well, this is the only way. And if, you know, and this is a very extreme versions of Christianity. Most Christians do not follow these ideas. But, you know, certainly the older Catholic Church was this way. It would say, look, this is the one way. This is what you need to believe. This is now how you need to worship, or you are going to hell or purgatory. It's that simple. And so I think that rubbed the competing and different religious traditions that coexisted with early Christianity the wrong way. And that, you know, set that into motion where that, you know, almost a war between Christianity and quote unquote paganism occurred. So it's an interesting history. Since we are going to try and do a little bit shorter show today, let's go ahead and jump into our wrap up. You wanted to go into this section, and I'd like you to do that and read some of the highlights, because there's some pretty exciting and deep stuff in the highlights from this this vision of Hermes with these different statements he's making about God.
Well, just to wrap up a little bit about the suffering in this dialogue between Hermes and the divine mind, this dragon, this luminous flying being that covered the sky. He talks about how, you know, thus suffering is the result of immortal man's falling in love with his shadow and giving up reality, with a capital R, to dwell in the darkness of illusion. That's Maya in the Hindu tradition, that we are an immortal being, but we're stuck. We're like shipwrecked on this mortal plane. And but that's so Buddhist, you know, that's the root of suffering.
Sure.
It's attachment to that. You know, we get sucked into it. And this whole conversation and this revelation, and not only was the doctrine revealed to Hermes, it also came with a mandate for him to go out and teach and to share this and to awaken the other sleeping souls.
Yeah,
The ones that were able to receive the message. Not everyone's ready
exactly at
any given time.
Sure.
But you still have to put it out there. For those that are, will get the message. Those that aren't might, when they wake up.
Sure,
and
exactly.
Receive it. And then there's a bunch of people that'll just say you're nuts and won't listen anyway. But and then, of course, they're not ready.
No, exactly.
And it's to the ignorant. He goes on, to the ignorant, the body is supreme. And they are incapable of realizing the immortality that is within them. Again, going back to the Father is within me, it's within you. Very, very similar. And there's a paragraph here right towards the end.
Page 105, is that the one you're talking about in the reader's
edition?
Yeah,
I'm actually not on the reader's edition, so my pagination might be.
Okay,
yeah, but you have it.
But it's towards the end of the section, the life and writings of Theothermes Trismegistus in Secret Teachings. So.
And this is, I think, some of the concluding statements that the Poimander, the light of the world, gave to him. It says, I order you to go forth to become as a guide to those who will wander in darkness, that all men within whom dwells the spirit of my mind, which is the universal mind, may be saved by my mind in you, which shall call forth my mind in them. So again, here's Hermes being used very much a Jesus type figure, or anyone who had a revelatory experience was also told to go out. But just to back that up again, it's like that all men within whom dwells the spirit of my mind. So it's already there. The universal mind is within all men.
Yeah.
But it's my mind in you, Hermes, which shall call forth my mind in them. So it's the God in me sees the God in you. Mm-hmm. I've heard that before, I'm saying. And very, very interesting, but very direct that Hermes was needed. If they can see this light in Hermes, that is the light of the world, they are also seeing the light in them, much in the way. So he's sort of a human or, you know, earth plane carrier of this message, whereas Hermes, you know, had to get it from the sky, just like Moses got it from Mount Sinai and, and all these places.
Yeah.
Goes on to say, establish my mysteries and they shall not fail from the earth, for I am the mind of the mysteries. And till mind fails, which is never, my mysteries cannot fail. And that's the last quote that he said.
Speaking of that, by the way, just a quick side interruption. Manly Hall points out how how Hermes in the Hermetic tradition is the foundation of all the rituals in Masonry, and why that's so important for Masons, why it's so important for Masons to study the Hermetic tradition and the wisdom of Hermes, because it is the basis of Freemasonry and all of its rituals. They you know, mythologically see their line going back to Hermes Trismegistus himself, Thoth. So anyway, that's an interesting point. Very good. I'm going to go ahead there and then and wrap us up. That was very, very great and condensed description and way of looking at that. Thank you so much for doing that. I want to give a couple of sources for the listener to check out. If you're interested, look at the Divine Poimander, which is either spelled Poimandres or Pymander, Divine Poimander, Hermes Mercurius Trismegistus. There's a Yogi publication one that's very good that you can find on Amazon. It's the blue covered one. It's edited by Paschal Beverly Randolph. That's an excellent one. It's a nice little bound hardcover blue book, which you will see. The Kabbalion, Hermetic Philosophy by Three Initiates is great. Of course, you can find the Emerald Tablet all over the internet. Some of the more modern stuff, Hauk stuff is good. HAUK.
And this chapter.
And most importantly, start with this chapter in the Secret Teachings. It's the life and writings of Thoth Hermes Trismegistus in the Secret Teachings by Mr. Manly P. Hall. All right. Well, we're going to wrap it up today. I hope you guys enjoyed this show, and I want everyone to have a great week. Thank you again, Chris, for being here. Each week. I appreciate you greatly, my friend. And everyone have a great week, and God bless.